Welcome to this podcast for Classical 91.5. I'm Julia Figueres. The Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra season is about to begin. And joining me today for a conversation on the eve of opening night, our pianist John Nakamatsu. Welcome, John.
Thank you.
And RPO Music Director Ward Steer.
Hi, Julia.
Welcome back to our studios, both of you. You're such a good friend of Rochester, John, and you're very busy this year. You've got a lot to do in this city.
A lot to do, and happily so. Always happy to be back.
So you're working with the RPO twice?
Twice.
And the Society for Chamber Music Rochester?
That's right. So at the beginning of the season and at the end of the season, I'll be here, well, twice for RPO and once for Chamber Music Rochester.
We are very, very lucky to have you here.
Well, I feel lucky as well.
And, of course, Ward, this is your second opening night.
That's right. And well, for the full season.
For the full season, yeah. Right. And this season is a big one for you. You've made some changes. You've done some really interesting things. And you've put together one theme that actually is going to be represented almost right out of the box. American music is big, big, big on the program this mm-hmm. year.
That's right. Yeah, the American theme runs actually throughout our entire season this year, and it's highlighted, of course, with the American Music Festival, which begins in October and finishes up at the very beginning of November. So it's three weekends, and I'm really thrilled about it because, as you know, there's so much great American music, and there's such a staggering array of styles and sounds in the American canon now that we're going to try to really explore that throughout the year. So you'll see a lot of American pieces, often opening programs, you know, after the American Festival has concluded, you know, later in the season. And this week for opening night, I thought we would kick things off this year with a great American piece by an American composer who actually has ties to Rochester, Ron Nelson. We're playing his Savannah River Holiday, which he wrote when he was, I think, a doctoral student at Eastman, actually, in the early 50s. And it's a wonderful piece. It's got a lot of spunk. It's got a lot of energy. I think it's just a great way to open any program, and especially this season, which focuses on American music.
And it's a piece that we most often hear as a wind ensemble, not as an orchestral work.
That's right. It was adapted for wind ensemble, and it's become pretty popular in that arena, if you will. But it is an orchestral piece, too. And I think it works. It's just... it's a barn burner, really, for the orchestra, and it's interesting because the theme, Savannah River Holiday, it was based on a short story, which is was originally called Savannah River Payday, believe it or not, but he was concerned that if he called it the same exact thing, he would have copyright issues, you know, legal things to deal with, so he changed it to Savannah River Holiday. But the short story is basically, you know, it takes one through the experience of the jubilation of, you know, a little bit of time off, a holiday, a payday. Just it's very happy feelings contrasted with relaxation and repose. So I think holiday was a good choice because it, you know, that's what everyone wants on a vacation, right? You want a lot of excitement and you want a little bit of relaxation, and it's got both those things. Ron Nelson didn't set out to go through the story, you know, in a chronological way or in a literal way, but it just it captures both of those emotions, I think, the excitement and the rest and the beauty of having a little bit of time off. So it's a nice way to get back into the season. I think it'll be a good way to kick off the year.
As you leave your holiday, you go into a new holiday.
That's right, absolutely.
Now, right after that comes our friend John Nakamatsu to play that piece of music, Rachmaninoff. You and Rachmaninoff, John, you seem to get along pretty well.
Well, I like him. Yeah, that's for sure.
Why do you like him?
Well, you know, there are certain composers where you feel that the music is actually written by a pianist for a pianist. And despite the difficulties or the demands, every time you play something of Rachmaninoff, you feel he understands physically what you need as an instrumentalist. And that's a big deal because, you know, there's a lot of great music, but not all of it fits very comfortably, you know, or ergonomically with, you know, your hand. There are composers like Brahms, for example, who I think is really writing orchestrally for the piano, and sometimes it just feels so wrong. Tchaikovsky also has that same uncomfortable type of passage work. César Franck comes to mind only because Juliana Athayde and I are playing snippet of his violin sonata tonight at an RPO function, and we were just marveling at how beautiful the music is and how uncomfortable it is to play. So, but that said, Rachmaninoff and this piece in particular just really feels like it's made for a pianist, and it's not to say that it isn't without its challenges, but at least it feels like the composer had us in mind somehow.
His work is very big. It's very dramatic. And it's really just got that huge thing going. You, I would say, tend to be kind of a quieter, more elegant performer. So how do you make those two things mesh, John?
Well, you know, I think in all great music, there are different ways of looking at the piece. And, you know, even when you listen to performers of Rachmaninoff's period, and unfortunately we have recordings of even Rachmaninoff himself, but also his peers, not all of this music was pounded out in the way that we have come to know it in many ways. And a lot of what attracted me to this period of playing, actually, was a sense of line and lyricism and legato that I think is missing often in Rachmaninoff's own music. So for me, you know, who knows what he would himself approve of as performance practice, but all we can do as performers is be true to our own conscience and determine what are the priorities musically and otherwise for ourselves as individuals and go in that direction. I mean, I don't claim to read this in any certain way except beginning with the score and the actual notations that Rachmaninoff left.
So let's talk about this big concerto, Ward and John. The more I hear this concerto over time, the more I like it. And one of the reasons why I really like it is the opening. The opening is spectacular.
It's a great dramatic piece of music. I mean, you can't get more drama than what you have right at the outset. It starts very quietly with the piano, but then suddenly the luscious strings just take over the main theme. That is even, just from a compositional standpoint, a challenge for us as performers because, you know, the strings often want to just play out this theme so much. And the pianist, although we're accompanying, sometimes gets buried in this texture. And that's one of the dangers that I think you find with this piece in general versus the third concerto, say, or even the first piano concerto, where the piano writing is such that you're always kind of out there and on top of the texture. Here, the piano writing, as impressive as it is often hidden within the texture of the orchestra. And it should, to a certain extent, be that way, because often we are not the main thing. We are part of the overall sonority. And I think that's what's fun about this, you know, working with Ward, and that we can find this balance actually very, very quickly.
Yeah, it's that opening. It's funny when you asked John just now about the opening, the first word that came to my mind was dramatic as well. I mean, it's just pianist by him or herself on stage there just setting the mood, and then the orchestra sort of just rushes in. It's like the floodgates are open. But as John said, the balance right from the beginning is crucial because you want that intensity. You want that lyricism and that depth of sound, but you also want the tension, I think, between the soloist, between the piano and the orchestral line, because if we completely swallow him, that's a pretty deflating experience after this great lead up for the audience, because they don't want to lose the, but I think keeping that balance right on the edge is really ideal. And so that's what we try to do in rehearsals and tweaking moments like that. Because, you know, if you think also about Rachmaninoff as a human being and sort of how his personal life consistently impacted his artistic life, this piece is important also because he was coming out of a first period of Great Depression and he had writer's block. And I think that element of struggle and then ultimate triumph over those struggles is key in this piece, as it is in many of his pieces, particularly his later pieces and middle period works. In fact, I think he dedicated it to a physician who helped him through his troubles, in fact. So from the very beginning, you want that perfect balance of tension, I think, between the orchestra and the soloist. And then it gives way, you know, it ebbs and flows throughout the rest of the piece thereafter.
There's a real sense of anticipation.
Absolutely.
When it begins. You know something really big is coming, mm-hmm. and it's just around the corner, and bang, there it is. Interestingly, the first time this was ever played, it was without the first movement. The mm-hmm. first time it was ever played, they played it just the second and third movements. It was almost a year later before the thing was done in its mm-hmm. entirety. I mean, I'm not quite sure why that would be.
Yeah, neither am I. Do you know, John?
No, I only know that Rachmaninoff wrote these pieces as vehicles for himself, really.
Right.
As you know, so however that gestation happened, I'm not exactly sure, but I do know that from the beginning, this piece was an instant hit. Mm-hmm. And you'll see why. I mean, if you don't know it, you may. And that's the thing. You know, every theme has been adapted in some way to some pop culture form. There's, you know, I think an Eric Carmen song of the second movement.
That's right, in the second movement.
Mm-hmm.
With that theme that Eric Carmen turned into All by Myself. This is such an iconic movement, which got turned into this huge pop hit as well. And there's something so deeply longing and sad in that movement.
But it's also got a great beauty and lyricism, I think, which is and it's another example. I mean, there are so many examples, I think, in especially in music, where sometimes the simplest thing is the most powerful. And it starts out again just simple chord progression to bring us, you know, from the ending tonality of the first movement into where we're headed in the second movement. It's just a nice little transition, but it's again rich, scored very low in low registers, are prominent, and so it's got a darkness about it. And then John emerges, the pianist emerges, and it's just very simple. It's almost like you start by playing the accompaniment,
right.
which is a very cool approach because it's a little bit disarming, I think, for the audience. And then the flute plays a beautiful line, and then the clarinet has the first iteration of the main theme. And again, the pianist, the soloist, is really just a chamber musician at that point playing with the orchestra, and it's not till later that the piano takes over as the main voice. It's really quite elegant, and it's exquisite.
I think you absolutely hit the nail on the head. I mean, the operative word being chamber music. I think people laugh at me when I say Rachmaninoff is the supreme example of playing chamber music. But I think in order to play these concertos well, every single person on stage, every element on that stage has to be in tune with all the others. And, you know, I find the least successful performances are the ones where the soloist is kind of just pulling everyone along with him, or blazing this huge path, which in some ways I suppose can be very exciting, but on the other hand, I think misses the whole point of what this music is, and it's completely layering with different voices and a million lines to listen to. And that's why I think there's so many ways of hearing the piece. You know, you think you're following the main line, but then suddenly on second hearing, you think, well, there's something else going on underneath that. And then there's something else going on underneath that. And that's, I think, the genius of Rachmaninoff in many ways.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of this thought that it's orchestral, and yet it's not.
Yeah, exactly.
And he writes like this all the time. Now, I wonder if this isn't this thought that he's this big, fat orchestral writer thing comes from this thing you were talking about a little earlier, John, that we bang things out more these days than they used to. And perhaps a performance of this 50 years ago would have been wholly different than what we hear today, orchestrally as well.
I think it's possible, although it's funny if you go back and listen to the, you know, the best recording. I don't know if there are more than one, but there's one that's fairly good quality that's been remastered of Rachmaninoff playing this piece himself. I wouldn't say that he's really, you know, too bombastic with it in the sense of, you know, being heavy-handed. However, it is extremely quick, which is a little disarming. I mean, he wrote a tempo which I think is very thoughtful and stately kind of in the opening, and if you listen to his own performance, he completely disregards that and just takes off. So I think that might also, you know, egg people on to think, oh, I have to really, you know. And, you know, not everyone's Rachmaninoff. In fact, there was only one. So, you know, you don't necessarily have to do that just because he did. And of course, whenever you listen to these historical recordings, I love to do it because it's fascinating, but you never know what the reason was or what things were at play on that day when they recorded it, because they didn't do it back then the way they do it now. They probably, in one afternoon, he came in and just ripped it out, you know, in 40 minutes without a lot of thought. And now, you know, 50, 60, you know, however many years later, we psychoanalyze every bar and think, why did he do that? Well, you know, you have to let that go a little bit. So I think not worrying so much about the flash and the elements of this piece that make it so instantly gratifying and wonderful to listen to, and thinking a little bit more in depth about what the meaning and the overall structure is. I think those are the keys these days to having really great, thoughtful performances.
I also think the question of, you know, today's relevance in terms of performance practice, you know, it is rooted in the experience of working with a living composer, because every time you read something new that has no tradition or that you've never heard before, and even if you're a composer that you don't know, invariably it comes back to the composer saying, well, I didn't think of it that way, but that's a valid way of playing or presenting mm-hmm. this music. And I think that most composers throw their stuff out there. They get it to the point where they feel confident and they allow it to be published, they allow it to be played. And in that point, at that point, it just kind of takes on a life of its own. And I would assume that people, you know, who might travel into the future and maybe found out a little bit about what our future actually is compared to their own world, might understand why their music evolved in such a way. I mean, I think that's the greatness of all of this music, is that it is constantly evolving into something that's relevant to us. And so whether or not Rachmaninoff would have approved is one way of looking at this. But another way is how we as a society still value this music and how it speaks to us today. And I imagine that 50 years from now, you know, or maybe even 30, when I'm about to end my career, that I would hear completely new interpretations of this piece that are driving the public equally crazy.
Now, you are assuming, of course, we're going to allow you to end your career.
At some point, I don't know that there's a choice.
So let's talk about just the third movement. How does he bring it all to an end? Because he brings it all to an end spectacularly.
Well, in the very typical Rachmaninoff fashion, I mean, there's, you know, the brilliant bravura section, which is the opening, and a lyrical section that knows no end. I mean, it's the theme that everybody wants to hear. You're waiting for it, and it happens, thankfully, four times, really. You can count the orchestra doing it, then the piano repeating it, then the orchestra doing it again, the piano repeating it, and actually five if you count the big wrap-up at the end where it's, you know, in biggest and brightest form, and it's so exciting. And you know, it's a simple way of, in some ways, constructing a piece, very formulaic, but at the same time, the way he does it is so artful and so economical. I think compositionally, it's probably the finest of all of his concertos. But even though I go back and forth between which is my favorite, but it is so great in proportion, and I think that's another key to making it, in terms of performance, successful, not giving away too much too soon. You know, as we're talking about being too big or too fast or too, you know, this whole thing is very, very intelligently laid out from the very first note to the very last note. And even between the movements in this piece, there are connections harmonically and mm-hmm. of, you know, texturally that really have to be brought up. And it's one big thought. And that's what's so I think, compelling about this work.
Yeah, and at the end, I mean, master dramatist, master of just holding the audience, building up the audience's anticipation and suspense. I love it because, you know, as John said, you hear the theme several times, but you'd never really feel satisfied with, and then he goes off in another direction, and then it just, he builds and builds and builds, and it's like a pressure cooker, and then right at the end, it's just the piano alone, and you're sort of, but that line of tension keeps going, and then it's like an explosion. Boom, the downbeat, and mm-hmm. then you hear the fully orchestrated, lush, rich iteration of that theme that everyone's just been dying for, and it drives forward, and then after you finish with that, Rachmaninoff says, okay, show's over, and it just has a little flourish push to the end, and it's just great. It's I mean, you couldn't design a piece better to have the audience leap to their feet and just feel total sense of satisfaction and excitement.
So how do you, orchestrally speaking, walk that line between romantic and schmaltz? Because it's a fine line, and you certainly can fall into the schmaltz side of things with Rachmaninoff.
Well, I always use the analogy of, you know, walking down the garden path and not stopping to admire every single posy along the way. Because if one does that, you just get stuck and you'll never get out. And while all of them are beautiful, there are so many great corners, great progressions, great moments in this piece, but they have to be connected. And you do make decisions and you say, okay, this, you know, we had our first rehearsal this morning and there were moments where it was like, okay, we're going to take a little time here. But there are others where you have to just go through and keep the longer line in mind. And so if you always think in terms of a big picture and the overall arc, it helps avoid those pitfalls, I think, where you can just be overindulgent because it's so tempting. I mean, every moment is just so beautiful. You want to stop and take full advantage of it, but it's not always in the best interest of the overall experience.
Would you choose a different posy to stop and admire in a different performance?
Yeah, sure. That's part of the fun of live performance. I mean, and there were moments this morning in our first rehearsal. We didn't have a lot of time to discuss it before, but, you know, John is so easy to work with and such a natural musician, I wasn't worried about it. And there were a couple moments that he took some time that surprised me a little bit, but I loved it. And so after I heard it, I thought, great, you know, this is how we're doing it this week, or at least this morning, and we'll see. You know, it's a constantly evolving process, you know.
How has your performance with Rock 2 evolved from when you began it to what we're going to hear with the RPO, John?
Well, that's always a difficult question to answer because, you know, I think with any piece, there's nothing that I'm consciously trying to layer on top of it in terms of what I want to do next. I think anytime you get to rework a piece, one, it's a great privilege because you have all of what you just did up until that point behind you, and then you get to look at it as though it's new again. And just that alone, just taking out the score, and before I even play it, just kind of going through it and looking at it, makes me already hear it differently. And then I have all the memories of the things that from the last performance that I really didn't like, and all the things that, you know, I thought, oh, I could do that better, and I could do this. So, you know, with that chance for renewal, I think comes this excitement of creating something with somebody who will then give me even other ideas that I probably didn't even think of while I was, you know, pondering all of that. So it's horribly exciting, I have to say. I mean, people say, well, you get your play the same thing every year. It's not like that at all. It's every time you get to do this, it's different. And I think even Thursday will be different than Saturday for us.
And for this also is different because of the other instrument that you're playing with, which is the orchestra. Your orchestras are going to be different. So
that's right. They all have their unique personalities. And because this is, as we said earlier, somewhat of a chamber-type environment, every soloist within the orchestra is going to play lines differently. And I have to figure out how I can fit into that and how we can all make it seem like we're of one mind.
And this is a piece that clearly resonates very strongly with the consciousness of people. It's been in anime. It was used in an Olympic floor exercise. It's been in several movies. This clearly strikes to the heart of people when they hear it.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just one of those pieces that instantly touches you. And, you know, what more can one say? I mean, it's got the it factor for sure.
Well, speaking of it factors, you close the concert with a huge it factor. It's one of our listeners' favorite pieces of music, and that's Beethoven's Seventh. Even Beethoven thought that this was one of his best. So let's talk about why this symphony of those nine has that kind of response.
Well, first of all, I think this symphony really... Some of Beethoven's symphonies march, some of them sing, some of them, you know, are just so full of angst. Some of them are a little bit happier and light-footed, but this one really dances. And I think that is the thing that sets it apart. I mean, it's if you could call it, you know, go out on a limb and call it a toe tapper, just in the sense of the connection with dance. It really is that. I mean, it was famously called the apotheosis of the dance by Wagner. And I think that's really a wonderful characterization of it, because every movement is in some way inspired by rhythm. And the rhythm and that element is key throughout. And much like the Rachmaninoff in the last movement, how it sort of propels you forward, it just, at every turn, the level of intensity is ratcheted up so that you're just so engaged the entire time. And then there, at the appropriate moments, I mean, he's perfectly proportioned, where he gives you, you know, rest and beauty and relaxation, and then, you know, turns on the gas again and gets you going forward and forward, and it wraps up in a sense of just complete exultation and jubilation, and it's life affirming. It's just one of these amazing experiences. Every time I get to the end of the symphony, I just feel, you know, just this glow of this journey and this experience with the orchestra and with the audience. It's amazing. And the way it begins, too.
Well, I was going to say, the way it begins gives you no hint about where you're about to go.
Which, again, is it links up a little bit with the Rachmaninoff in that sense dramatically, which is one reason I liked the pairing. But the opening is rather, it's stately and noble. It's beautiful. It goes through a lot of different, the chord changes are interesting, because he establishes some tension and dissonance right away between different harmonic centers that he'll visit throughout the piece. And so you have this grandiose opening chord, the full orchestra, you know, forte, fortissimo on the downbeat. And then it goes from that all the way down to a single oboe, so the contrast is really striking. So you get the power and the lyricism, the large and the small, right in that microsecond, you know, right off the bat. Not even a complete bar has gone by, and he's already given us that. And then after the sort of chorale-like figures and the woodwinds, which are punctuated by the full orchestra and the strings and the downbeats, you get the beginning of these scales, which, again, the whole opening, I have to say, is an example of one of the reasons I love Beethoven so much, because he writes things that, you know, if you were a composition student and you took it into your teacher, you know, they'd look at it on the paper and say, that is the most simple-minded thing I've ever seen in my life. What are you doing with this? You know, you're just writing scales here, and you know, where are you going with this? Well, in Beethoven's hands, the scales in between this amazing opening, which with so much going on and so little time, and then where we're headed when the vivace starts, it's perfect, because the scales, ascending scales, give us like a real sense of building and anticipation. And so they start very softly, and then there's a big crescendo, and then the scales continue. But then he throws in one other element, which is the same half note singing figure that the oboe began with rather quietly. But then it gets thrown into the strings with sforzando and a fortissimo, you know, sostenuto. It's very simple, but it sort of soars above the 16th notes, which are the motor driving us forward, and all of a sudden you feel like the symphony really starts to take flight, and it's like, whoa, but where am I going? We're still in the introduction, right? So this continues on and continues on, and it's just so, it sort of, he transports you to this other place. And then once we arrive, there's a long pedal on an E, and so E is the dominant of A, and A is the key, the home key. And so the orchestra, this is another one of those places where if you looked at it on the page, you know, the composition teacher might say, this is idiotic. You just have repeated E's over and over and over and over and over again. I read once someone counted them, there's like 60-something E's in this section leading into the vivace. But, you know, because of what he's done with the scales and because of what he's done with the half notes and the texture and the combination, by the time we get to that point, we're prepped, we're amped, but we still don't know where we're going. So one of my favorite moments is at the very end of the introduction. The orchestra comes, you know, all together on these E's, and you hear the strings play it first, and then the violins and the oboe and the flute exchange just E's. It's back and forth. And we really, again, we really don't know where we're going, and then there's one moment, like two bars before the vivace, where the E, we sort of, I think of it as we sort of turn a corner, and this E that's been sitting there, you know, the dominant of A, and where are we going, where are we going? Just before the vivace starts, the E comes to life. And all of a sudden, we turn that corner, and then we're led to this wonderful dance, and then the E starts to dance. And the whole orchestra comes in. And from that point, we're off and running. And this dotted 8th, 16th rhythm that I was just singing very horribly is the key. And, of course, it's the same. This rhythm is, you know, infamous all throughout classical music. It's the rhythm of the Ride of the Valkyries, after all. But it's got a tremendous sense of forward motion and weight also. We've talked a lot about that this week, putting the right amount of cantabile and length on the dotted eighth so that it goes through the 16th but is still crisp and snappy enough that we're propelled forward, but with this deen da dun deen da dun deen da, it, you almost get the feeling of, you know, riding on a horse. The gallop, the gait is very important. But that lyricism, which is established right in the beginning, is also contained within this figure. So his use of it, I think, is absolutely brilliant. And then throughout the first movement, he gives us moments where it's not a dotted eighth sixteenth, which means the note is not quite as long. He puts an eighth with a sixteenth rest, which sounds a little different. So instead of dee da da dee da da, it's dee da da dee da da dee. So it gives a little bit of breathing room for another line to peek through the texture there. And those subtle details, I think, are often overlooked because this piece is so well known and everybody wants to play it. And so oftentimes you don't really roll up your sleeves and really polish it. But when you take time to appreciate those details, the piece just comes alive in a way that is stunning.
And of course, after that is the movement.
The second movement,
the Allegretto. The King's Speech.
Yeah, that's right.
That has inspired composers to write entire pieces mm-hmm. about this piece. It's extraordinary. It's probably one of the most perfectly written movements in mm-hmm. the history of symphonies.
And it's so simple, which is, you know, again, beauty through simplicity. It's just, and again, it's about rhythm. So you get this pulse, this heartbeat, if you will, that's just starts right after the opening chord. We get a minor chord at the beginning that sort of fades away, and then as the woodwinds and the horns are fading out, we get the beginning of this pulse, and it's just bum 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 bee. And it kind of, I think, it has to float if you do it right. This is an interesting thing because he writes tenuto on the first note in each bar, so, you know, tenuto is bum bum, but tenuto meaning long or held. But the marking at the beginning of the movement is allegretto. He didn't write andante. He didn't write adagio, certainly. He didn't write anything about a funeral march. I mean, if Beethoven wanted this to be a funeral march, he certainly would have written that, because we know very well, look at the Third Symphony, he knew how to write a funeral march. But this is not a funeral march. And again, often this piece, I think, is interpreted in a very heavy, almost militaristic way in the way this rhythmical figure is treated. But we're not doing that this week, because I think that the lyricism is the overarching element that is most important in this movement in particular, and also in the entire symphony. You know, lyricism through the dotted 8th 16th note, lyricism through this quarter 8th note figure that I just sang, because tenuto doesn't necessarily have to mean heavy on the front. It can mean sustained through and cantabile. And so if you look at it from that perspective, the orchestra is already singing when the heartbeat begins, and then you get the second theme, which comes in on top of it, and it's layered so gradually and so beautifully. You can just close your eyes and listen, and it's like slipping into a warm bath, and then it just, you know, it sort of grows, and you just, it blossoms, and it's a huge arc. It's like, you know, gradually walking up a beautiful hillside or something, you know, in the radiant warm sun, and then you walk down the other side, and you have this beautiful second theme, which is very pastoral, and you get floating lines in the woodwinds and a little churning in the strings, and it's just very gentle and very calm, very peaceful. And then, you know, the main theme comes back again. So again, you hear the themes in the right proportion at the right time, so it's very satisfying by the end. And then it's sort of, after you've come up over that hill and gone down the other side, you sort of walk off into the distance, and it kind of fades away. And again, it's, as you said, it's really a perfectly composed movement. It was I mean, I said it's very satisfying, it's totally satisfying, but the audience at the premiere was not satisfied because they asked for it to be encored multiple times, but I can understand why. And then we go into something completely different in the third movement, which is a scherzo, a presto. It's fun. It's got a lot of bubbling, great energy. Again, it's lively. It's dance. It's in three triple meter time. So it's way too fast for a waltz, of course. But it's just got this feeling of great celebration and jubilation about it. And again, it's very simple. We have that really lively section contrasted with a more pastoral section, a more calm section, which he writes in the score should be significantly slower than the opening. And again, it's just so beautiful. The chords, the way they're voiced, it's just, it really floats. The whole thing is just, up on a cloud somewhere. It completely transports you. And it's really fun. It's rambunctious, that third movement. I think it's, Beethoven was really the one who started the idea of the scherzo and the symphony. I mean, Haydn did so much for the symphony as a form, and then Beethoven, of course, studied with Haydn, and Beethoven took it to another level here, because this is where the minuet would go, in a Haydn symphony. But Beethoven, this is not the first time he did this, he had been doing this for a few symphonies by this point. But the really lively, energetic third movement, I think, puts us in a good place for the finale. And again, what's he going to do with the finale?
Well, Sir Thomas Beecham said
about the fourth movement. I know what you're going to say.
What do you do with it? It's like a lot of yaks jumping about. So what do you do with that fourth movement?
You jump about. I mean, it's just that's my job. No, I'm the yak on the podium. I read that. I remember the first time I read that quote, I was like, oh, come on. I mean, it's true. There's not a lot to it. It doesn't have the profundity of some of the other movements. But I think to describe it as, what can you do with it? That's selling it a little bit short. No offense to Sir Thomas, but it's got a great. Again, it's the dance rhythm is key, and he takes what he does in this movement that I love is he shows that the string section can be rhythmically incisive and be a texture in and of itself, because they're just going, and no one had really written for the string section like that in such a vigorous way. I mean, it's really extraordinary, and it's a workout for them, make no mistake about that. But it's also got that tremendous energy, and here again, the form and the proportion is important, and I do it with all the repeats, which I think is important because he throws in a couple curveballs every now and then. So after you get through this really, raucous party music, this, really exalted, energetic music, he keeps going with the theme, but then he starts elongating a note here and there. So it's kind of jarring, like he breaks the pattern. And so that's why it's important to do all of the repeats, because you kind of get lulled into this sense. I mean, you're following the pattern and you're into it, you're grooving on it, and then all of a sudden he pulls the rug out from under you for a minute to hold your attention, which is great. And there's a great churning and there's a great development of the rhythmical energy, but also the harmonic energy, the dynamic energy at the end. I mean, it's a long, slow burn, but it's really great the way he just ratchets it up. There's a lot of chromaticism. I think when he first wrote the symphony, some of his jealous contemporaries said, oh, he's ripe for the madhouse, because he's written all these crazy chromatic lines. And no, it's amazing the way the symphony is just so deft and so nimble, and it just snakes through all these different chromatic lines while still maintaining that absolute direction with the insistent dance rhythm that's going on throughout the whole thing. So it winds. It's almost like going, driving a sports car, down a windy road at the end of the day. It's just so exciting and, keeps you on the edge of your seat, and it builds and builds and builds, and then he throws another curveball in toward the end where we're up to, very intense dynamic. We've been going, and then he cuts everything out and he builds it again from a very soft dynamic, but everything comes rushing back in quickly, so it's not a long development again. And then the end is just celebratory and just amazing. It makes me want to jump up and down, which I may do in the performance, because it's just so exciting. It's so exciting. I love it.
I'm behaving myself. I am behaving myself in the concert hall, but when I'm listening to this in my car or in my house, I'm doing like air punching with the fourth movement.
It's,
I'm punching the air.
It's great.
It's like going to a Springsteen show. This is like great stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's the best ever. So you are a music director, John, and before I let you go, I wanted to have like a music director to music director conversation about how you all do your programming and what you all look to do when you program a season. You just came off of your 10th season, I believe, with the Cape Cod Chamber Music Festival. Right. You and John Manassi are the co-artistic directors of this. How did it go?
Great. First, the 10 years have flown by, but also we've had the best, in terms of ticket sales, the best season we've had ever. And this is the 37th season of the festival. So we're very excited going forward and building on the energy that we had this year.
The concert that I went to was packed, absolutely packed, and well-loved. People were clearly so happy with what you all did in that concert. It was just wonderful. And my kids liked it, too.
That's the biggest test of all, actually. So thank you for being there, and thank you for bringing them.
When the 20-year-olds put their thumbs up, you know you've done something
right. That's right.
So how do you each of you, imagine your season? When you begin to sit down with a pen and a paper and the blank page of X number of dates to be filled, where do you start, Ward?
I usually start with some sort of theme or thread which can connect everything throughout the year and kind of go from there. So I go from large to small, you know, big picture to small picture. And if you use this season, which we're about to begin as an example, the thread was American music. And by the way, I just give you a little bit of inside knowledge here. Originally, I wanted to do an American music festival. I wanted to focus for, you know, at least 2 weeks, maybe three, on American composers. And so that was established. But when I was going through it with my artistic administrator, we had so many ideas. I mean, you should have seen the wall with all the Post-its on that day. We had all these pieces I wanted to do, some that I didn't know that he had suggested, and I had looked at the scores and heard recordings, and I just loved it all. And I said, man, we don't have enough space in these 3 weeks. It's impossible. Richard Decker, said, well, why don't we spread it out over the entire season? And I said, brilliant, let's do that. So the collaborative element, I think, is very important. I mean, I'm sure, John, you would agree, I rely on my colleagues and you know, my artistic administrator especially to bounce ideas off and to get different inspiration and just to have that conversation going. So what we ended up with, I think, is really wonderful. So now we know we have an American-themed season. At the pinnacle of it is the American Music Festival. There's American music throughout. Great. So now what do you want to do? And then I looked at pieces that I wanted to do with the orchestra, pieces that maybe haven't been played in a while here in Rochester that our audience might enjoy. And I started to make decisions. I mean, I knew I wanted to do a Mahler symphony. I considered several of them. I'm not going to tell you which ones because you might see them in future seasons. But we arrived at Mahler 5, which I'm very happy about.
The hit.
Well, you know, yeah. That's a good one. That and one are done most. But I like all of them, actually. Then we started looking at artists that we wanted to work with. And, you know, John and I have worked together before. And I know he's got such a great history here in Rochester, and everyone loves him in the orchestra and in the community. So, you know, we worked together, what was it, a year and a half ago, in California. And ever since then, I was wanting to bring him back during my time here as music director. And then again, talking about the collaboration, the conversation, it was, I think, Richard Decker who pointed out, or maybe Jeff Tysick pointed out that, you know, it's been about 20 years since Van Cliburn and about, is it 10 since the record with Jeff?
Years, yeah.
So those two anniversaries sort of popped out and I thought, well, why don't we, if John's up for it, and thank God he was, why don't we have him, you know, open both subscription and on pops and fills. And that's a unique thing to have a soloist open both series.
You have a unique soloist.
We do.
We can talk about John as if he weren't here.
Absolutely.
It's okay. He is so versatile.
Right.
And his chops are extraordinary. I mean, he's got the big Rachmaninoff chops, but he's got that great jazzy, nimble thing to do a Gershwin mm-hmm. with. It's really great.
Well, and I think that the whole thing, I mean, ideally when you, and I'm sorry, John, if I'm monopolizing this,
I want to hear what you say. I'm learning.
No, but
this is wonderful.
It has to be a conversation because then so many things start to come into place because, you know, as I just said, we began in one place and then when all these things started to come together, it just started feeling so right because I was struck then by, you know, part of the reason I wanted to highlight American music this year is because I think our orchestra plays it extremely well. And what I mean, and the reason I say that is because I think so many different styles and elements go into the American musical canon that you really have to be adept at, you know, not only playing a jazz tune or jazz-infused music, influenced music. You know, if you look at composers like Gershwin and Bernstein, I mean, that has become classical, and that has also influenced those who came afterward. But then you also have composers like Charles Ives, who are completely different, and then you have composers like Aaron Copland, who's not at all, you know, I wouldn't call him a jazz-influenced composer, but he was writing in that era, so it's part of the sort of subconscious during that period. But I know a lot of orchestras who can play, say, Copland 3 just amazingly well with such power, but they may not be able to play, you know, a jazz show with the same level of commitment and style and panache that the RPO can. And so the fact that the orchestra can do all those things, I think, makes them ideally suited to American music, which is why I originally had the idea. But then when I realized that we had a soloist who had a history with Rochester who has that same multifaceted, amazing quality about his musicianship, I thought, that fits in perfectly with our season. Having a soloist, a beloved soloist in Rochester who can not only open our Phil's subscription, but open our Pops. And I thought, man, this is great. And when you're planning a season and the ideas just start to snowball like that, that's when it gets really exciting. And then all of a sudden you've been in the room for 4 hours and you don't know where the time went, but you have all these ideas, you know, and then you have to figure out how to implement them.
That's right.
You're beloved.
Who would have thought?
He said this. Really. I heard Ward say it. You are beloved.
Well, and so, it's on radio. So.
So now this is my question to you, John, because when you and John Manassi sit down to put together a series, to put together the Cape Cod Chamber Music Festival, you have a couple of challenges, and one of which is that you cannot make it about a platform for you and John.
No.
I know a lot of chamber series do that. When they create, and especially in the summer, you know.
Definitely.
Oh, it's a chance for me to be the star.
That's right.
for 6 or 7 weeks. You can't do that, though. So what are you and John actually looking to do when you put together a season?
Well, it's kind of a mirror of what Ward just said. I mean, the process is quite similar, even though, you know, our festival is a fraction of what the RPO is, and, you know, the halls that we are trying to fill are a small percentage of what the RPO's hall is. But we essentially do the same thing, and that is we start by what we call clustering, and that's a term I borrowed from, I think, one of my English teachers in college, you know, just throwing out any idea, no matter how ridiculous you think it is, just any possibility, and that leads to other ideas. And so, you know, it could also lead to panic, which it often does during this period, because it looks like nothing is ever going to happen. You know, you're just throwing around all these random ideas, and how are you going to actually find a way to coalesce and become a season? Well, then all these other limiting factors come into play. So, for example, then you start thinking specifically, what works do you want to play? What composers? What period? Is there a theme that we have to think about, or is there a special anniversary of a composer? Is there something? That's one level. Then there are the artists that we want to invite. There are groups that come in, and often the groups themselves have their own agendas in terms of repertoire, so we have to factor that in to the overall, you know, not repeating, not doing too much of Beethoven every year. If the, you know, he's the most popular composer, but he sells the most tickets for us, but do we really want to have him on every program? Probably not, because also, part of our job is to expose our audience to a wider range of music that we think is worth hearing and that they often come and enjoy. And then you have considerations that are less interesting, like budget, which definitely factor into how much we can or can't do. Marketability, the public appeal of certain things. You know, we tend to be very idealistic as artistic directors, but there is this other side that we have to respect what is supporting the whole organization in the first place, and that is the audience and the financial supporters and our board, who work very, very hard to keep this whole endeavor afloat. So with all of that, it becomes a very interesting kind of puzzle. And so, you know, if you're throwing up all the pieces in the beginning, at some point, two will fit together, and from there you start to build the core. And I think that's where it then for us becomes fun, because it doesn't look like it's impossible. And other things evolve, even sometimes where initial ideas fail, you know, where the fourth quartet you've asked has said no, then suddenly one comes in and it changes your whole season. And you end up going in a different direction that you didn't think possible at first. So, you know, we love when a season is successful, and especially like the last one, where every concert, it was just almost better than the previous. And then we get a little scared after the season's over, because we think, well, what are we going to do now?
So what are you going to do now?
We have no idea. I don't know. We'll come up with something. Please come back.
we'll get back to you on
good,
that
okay.
Yes, I may have an idea for you as well.
Great.
So we should probably be wrapping it up, but I do want to ask each of you how you determine, beyond the number of tickets sold, how you determine that you have just put together a successful season. Ward?
Well, I think I'll let you know at the end of it, but once you get to the last season, I guess I can use this as an example. At the end of the year, I felt like the orchestra was in a different place than we were in the beginning, for the better. So I think we grew musically, artistically, as an ensemble together. And I also felt like our relationship with the community and the audience grew as well. And in sense of, you know, we felt like they were more engaged. The enthusiasm was getting ratcheted up also. And that's reflected in ticket sales. But it's a feeling. We feel it on stage. We feel it in the hall. We feel it, you know, in the grocery stores when we're out and about and people are talking about the orchestra. I mean, that kind of buzz is great. And so you want that, and you want the constant artistic growth, and you want to keep raising the bar. And I think we did that last season, and I hope we do it again this year.
John?
Well, you know, for us, it's different because we have different players every season. We don't have one artistic body that necessarily is improving in that way. But I think in another sense, our evaluation of a season is much like what Ward just said. Your personal satisfaction, as you know, the feeling you get when you are done with that last concert overall, you know, it's kind of an exit poll. Do you feel like everybody had a great time? And that's the bottom line. And I think the other operative word for us anyway is trust, because we do not program all chestnuts, and we are on almost every program, there's something that somebody doesn't know or has never heard before. And that's been one of our pushes. You know, what we ask ensembles to do things that they haven't done, and we do things that we've never seen before. And so when an audience member comes up to us and says, we've never heard of this, we weren't sure about it, I'm glad I heard it. That's enough for me to already, you know that we've established some level of trust. And I think building on that is how you build your series.
I want to thank you both for coming in, Ward. It's been a pleasure always.
As always, thank you.
And John, I know we'll be talking again.
I look forward to it.
We'll be talking again, and we will as well, Ward.
Thank you.
Our guests today, John Nakamatsu, the pianist, and Ward Steer, the music director of your Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra, for their concert. And the season that is just about to start, it's been great having them here. If you would like more information about the Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra season, you can go to rpo.org. I'm Julia Figueres. This podcast is a production of WXXI Public Broadcasting.